It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, back live. And for the rest of the program today, we're going to be talking about misophonia. This is a condition where certain sounds, like chewing food or crinkling paper or the repeated clicking of a pen, those specific sounds produce a strong emotional reaction in the listener. And to be clear, this is not mere annoyance. It's anger. Sometimes physical symptoms come up, like increasing blood pressure. Sometimes there's a behavioral reaction, like getting up to leave or even yelling at someone about how they are eating. Misophonia is still an area where the research is relatively young. It's not actually a disorder recognized by psychology's gold standard diagnostic and statistical manual, the DSM-5, but two researchers from the University of Illinois are doing their part to advance understanding of misophonia. Professor Howard Barenbaum is in the Department of Psychology, and Professor Fatima Hussein is with the Department of Speech and Hearing Science. They're collaborating on an international study of misophonia in the United States, Brazil, and South Korea. They also collaborated on an earlier study of misophonia among college students, the results of which were recently published in the journal Ear and Hearing. I'm sure you're all subscribers. Professor Barenbaum and Professor Hussein are joining me in studio today. Welcome to the 21st Show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And we're also joined today by an advocate for people with misophonia. Chris Edwards is the founder and president of the nonprofit SoQuiet.org. Chris joins us remotely. Thanks for making the time to be with us. Welcome.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And listeners, you can join our conversation today by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, Professor Barenbaum, I want to begin with you. Beyond my sort of cursory explanation there, what is misophonia?
Well, I think you described it pretty well, actually, but it's people who have certain sounds. It's not all sounds, but certain types of sounds. Common ones include chewing, breathing, throat clearing, so a lot of bodily sounds. And they can be extremely upsetting, debilitating, in fact, and can have a profound impact on people's daily lives.
Yeah. Chris, can you give us an example from your life? What triggers your experience of this?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think he covered it pretty well. For me, I'm almost 50. I've had this most of my life, and definitely before there was even a term for it, but it affected my schooling. And for me, what we would call triggers or activators are, just as you said, a lot of eating noises, but also crinkling plastic, clicking pens, foot tapping. There's also visual triggers. This is something that hasn't been researched a whole lot, but people twirling their hair or picking at their nails are also triggers for me. And we have a lot to learn about it, but it affects everything I do.
Yeah. I mean, to the extent you're comfortable talking about it, let's say you're at a restaurant and, you know, someone in the booth behind you is just like loudly chewing up their, you know, whatever. You're in a movie theater and somebody's rustling that popcorn and crunching it. Oof. What physically, talk about what your physical experience of that is.
I understand it's a little tough to understand, but you absolutely covered it. It is way more than annoyance. I don't think anybody enjoys those sounds, but this is a very abnormal reaction to completely normal, non-threatening sounds. And for me, the feeling is, it feels like a panic attack. I have to get up and leave. It's not, I cannot ignore it. I cannot tune it out. My brain hyper-focuses on that one sound involuntarily, and it instantly drives me crazy. And yeah, I usually just either have to leave or move. It's very common for me to go someplace and have to leave and come back later, or, you know, it affects everything. I recently took an Amtrak trip up to Chicago, and my wife and I ended up moving seats probably four or five different times just to get to a location on the train that was not gonna be triggering for me. And there's things we can do. If my base mood is kind of chilled out, yeah, I try to remain relaxed most of the time, and that can help me get through things. I carry foam earplugs and headphones everywhere I go.
Sure.
And that can help me stay in a situation.
Yeah, we'll come back to the sort of practical aspect.
I got off track. Sorry.
No, no, that's all right. So, but I do want to ask, and Professor Fatima Hussein, let me bring you into the conversation now. Based on what we just heard, what do we understand about what is actually happening in the brain when somebody is having this experience?
So I think it's very interesting that the same sounds have such different reactions in different people. So the chewing does not bother me, right? And physically, it's the same sound. So I became interested in it because I'm a hearing neuroscientist, and I wanted to understand why this physical sound is producing such distinct, different activations in the brain, and different brain regions are involved. So there are, you're finding slightly different things depending on which paper you read. So this is a very nascent field. We know the emotion processing centers of the brain are involved differently. Those centers that respond to pleasurable music, for instance, are engaged differently in misophonia. So it is not just the sound itself, but this entirety of the psychological reaction that sets up is what we can image when we do brain imaging, for instance.
So you're putting people in that machine that it produces the rainbow graphics of their heads.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we do that here locally in Beckman. And across the world, there have been a few centers that have looked at it, and they're finding, again, this is very nascent field of research, so we're finding different brain regions being activated and how they're communicating with each other. So we need a lot more studies and not a lot more replication to hone and to develop one specific theory of it.
Yeah. Professor Barenbaum, you're in the Department of Psychology here. What does it mean that this is not, as I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, not sort of recognized by the DSM-5?
Well, my bet is it will be in the DSM-6, but that's several years off. I think that this is something which has probably always been around, but people didn't talk about. And it's not so common that you discuss it, you know, in everyday conversation. And now that people are becoming more aware of it, people are doing research on it, we're learning that it's much more common than anyone imagined, though there's still a long way to go to get really good epidemiological data. But people just, it was sort of hidden away, is my sense, and it's sort of coming out of the shadows now.
How common is it? I mentioned that study in the journal Ear and Hearing that looked at college students specifically. I don't know if, you know, there's a debate in psychology, right, about how representative is the college student population, but what is your understanding of how common or uncommon this is?
Well, let me say, as a scientist, I don't think we really know.
Yeah.
And part of the problem also is that it's not clear where to draw the line. Mm-hmm. So if someone is bothered a little bit by certain sounds, do they have misophonia? So we don't really know even whether this is something that is like height. You could be anywhere from, you know, really short to really tall or somewhere in the middle, or is it something that there's a certain threshold? And if you get above that point, look out, it's a real problem. We don't know that sort of critical question we don't know the answer to. And because we don't know those answers, because there aren't clear diagnostic criteria, no one's able to estimate it, but people are throwing out numbers like 5%. But we really don't have a good idea. It's probably not very rare. My bet is it's not very common either, but 5% I think is currently maybe the best guess.
Yeah. Chris, let me ask you about that. So Professor Barenbaum there raised the idea of maybe a spectrum of how, you know, how much this affects people. I'm sure you've heard people say like, dude, get over it. I'm just eating my lunch here. Come on, deal with it. How do you explain this to people?
That's a great question. Dr. Barenbaum had a good definition, which is once it starts impacting your life, your ability to do normal activities that we would expect, like schooling or social life or work, then it becomes a disorder and becomes disabling. And we don't know those numbers yet. But I understand that it doesn't make sense. Any kind of disorder or disease or condition is oftentimes hard to understand, and they don't make sense. If you didn't know what a peanut allergy was and you described a peanut allergy to somebody, it sounds ridiculous. Like why would a Reese's peanut butter cup send you to the hospital? So I understand that there's some skepticism about it, but this is a recognized condition now. And as Dr. Hussein mentioned, we're in the early phases of understanding it and researching it, and we still have a lot to learn. But I understand the curiosity about its validity. But you know, for me, I can tell you it's affected every aspect of my life for decades, and can be disabling for sure.
Yeah, you mentioned your schooling. Can you talk a little bit more, to the extent you're comfortable sharing that,
yeah,
about how, you know, how you, because again, I think you mentioned you're of an age, this has only been sort of recognized as a thing for about 20 years now. I'm guessing you were pretty much done with school by that point. Talk about
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I can connect the dots looking backwards. And I didn't find out the word misophonia until probably about 2007, 2008. I was born before Star Wars came out. And so, you know, it being recognized and having a word has been very influential. But connecting the dots looking backwards, I can tell it affected my grades and my social life and my career trajectories. I was able to go to college and suffer through classes and actually ended up going through grad school as well. But if I had known, or if society had known, that this was a recognized condition, that I could have gotten some accommodations, some disability accommodations in classes, I think my grades would have been better. I would have been able to focus and not be so stressed out and so distracted by common sounds in the classroom, like somebody eating crackers or clicking their pen. Mm-hmm. And but I don't want other people to suffer like I did, because we didn't know back then in the 80s.
Right, right. I want to, and I'm not sure which of our in-studio guests is better equipped to talk about this, but talk about linkages between misophonia and some other more, I would say, long-standing diagnoses or conditions. Is there a relationship to sensory processing disorder?
I can take with respect to hearing.
Okay, sure.
So we are finding a very close link or correlation between misophonia and hyperacusis. So
what is hyperacusis?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's a condition where the loudness of everyday sounds bother you. The sounds which wouldn't bother my neighbor sitting next to me will bother me, for instance, right? But that's all sounds, and it depends on the loudness level of it. If they're above a certain loudness, they start bothering me, for instance. I have hyperacusis. Now you got Chris having misophonia, and you can have me having hyperacusis, but I do not have misophonia. And what we found in that ear and hearing paper was that there was a lot of our young adults in our study who had both conditions. So typically, the literature has described one or the other. And what we're finding that there was a larger group which had both conditions. So you're bothered by the loudness of a lot of sounds as well as a few specific sounds. So one of the things with misophonic triggers is that they may be the softest of sounds to, you know, around you, but still bother you. Right?
Yeah.
There may be whispered sounds around you, but still bother you. And that's not the case with hyperacusis. So, but there's a close link, we think, and we are trying to probe that. So that's with respect to hearing disorders. We also see a lot, I will leave the psychological overlap
sure.
to Dr. Berenbaum.
So yeah, what about that? I mentioned sensory processing disorder. I was also curious about ADHD, autism spectrum.
Sure. We don't really know much yet about sensory sensitivities. I don't think there's been much good research on that, though one of the many things that we'll be studying in our next project. But in terms of other mental disorders, misophonia co-occurs much more than you'd expect by chance with a wide range of mental disorders, including depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, autism spectrum conditions, you name it. So it tends to go along with a variety of mental health challenges.
Yeah. And Chris, I know in your work, and I've read some of your published writing and some of your other interviews you've done or heard some of them, you've talked about that overlap with people you've encountered with misophonia as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We know that it is possible to have misophonia and not be diagnosed or have a co-occurring condition. But as Dr. Berenbaum said, we're finding that it co-occurs, not with a specific one of those, but in general co-occurs with other known conditions. I've also been diagnosed with ADD. I kind of have it moderately, but that's pretty normal.
Chris, what did it... When you mentioned 2007, how did you first encounter this concept of misophonia as a name for something you had experienced your entire life?
That's a great question. I discovered it online. The term, of course, was coined in 2001 by two audiologists, but it sort of sat in obscurity for about 10 or 12 years before any research before it was discovered more by the psychology field and research in that field on it, kind of picked up around 2012, 2013 is when it first began. But I found out about it around then. Again, I don't have any record of it, but it was, I think it was on Reddit or some other forum for people with misophonia. And it was just one of those aha moments. And people get emotional because they find out this thing that has caused them such suffering for so many years actually has a name, and that other people have it and they were not alone. And I felt that way. I felt very validated and amazed that it wasn't just me being a strange person who's particular about sounds for some reason.
Yeah, I wonder how you had thought about this experience before learning, you know, for I guess the most of your life, or the majority of your life at least, before learning there was a term for it.
Mm-hmm. It was just one of those things I never talked about. I can look back and I tried to advocate for myself, but when you bring it up, it sounds crazy. You know, I remember at some point I stopped eating dinner with my family, and they were sort of accommodating, not knowing anything about it to that. So I would eat dinner in my room because I didn't like the sound of them doing that. And my dad was my father is a kind of a nail biter, and that really drove me crazy. That was a big trigger looking back, but I didn't know that. And so I couldn't be around him while he was doing that. And we just didn't know. And I suffered in silence a lot, just gritting my teeth and powering through, which was probably not good for my mental health looking back.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we know more now.
All right. We are going to take a break. Let me reintroduce our conversation for those just joining us. We're talking today about misophonia. It's a condition where certain sounds like chewing food or crinkling of paper, dripping of a faucet, they produce a strong emotional reaction in the listener. This is something, it's an area where there is still a growing understanding. And today we're talking to two people working to build our understanding of that. Professor Fatima Hussein is with the Department of Speech and Hearing Science at the University of Illinois. Professor Howard Barenbaum is in the Department of Psychology. We're also talking with Chris Edwards, the founder and president of the nonprofit SoQuiet.org, which advocates for people with misophonia. If you want to join our conversation, do you feel heard today or seen today, as they say? 800-222-9455 is the number to join us. 800-222-9455. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are spending the rest of our program today on misophonia. This is a condition where certain sounds, like chewing food, for example, can produce a strong reaction in the listener. There's emotion. Sometimes there are physical symptoms, a heart rate or blood pressure increasing. Sometimes people react with their behavior. They get up to leave, or they might even yell at someone to try and get them to stop making this sound. It's an area where we're still learning a lot about it. As we talked about before the break, it's not currently recognized by psychology's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, currently on edition 5. But as one of our guests says, he expects or suspects it will be recognized in the next edition, number 6, coming out in the future. Our guests for this conversation are Chris Edwards, who is founder and president of the nonprofit SoQuiet.org, a misophonia advocacy organization, Professor Fatima Hussein with the Department of Speech and Hearing Science at the University of Illinois, and Professor Howard Barenbaum in the Department of Psychology at U of I. They are both collaborating on an international study of misophonia in the U.S., Brazil, and South Korea. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. 800-222-9455. Professor Hussein, talk about this study you're undertaking. What are you hoping to learn?
So it sort of outgrew from a previous study. We recognized, as you mentioned, our previous study focused on college-age students. which led us to think about across the lifespan how misophonia changes or does not change. And as you heard Chris talk about his own experiences going through adulthood. So it led, as we were talking, some of our participants were international students here at U of I, which led us to think about cultural and other linguistic, perhaps, influences on misophonia and whether those were how they affected both what sounds were triggers for misophonia. Does that change across cultures? And how does the person react to it? And maybe Dr. Berenbaum has more to add here.
Sure.
Since we really don't know that much, an international study starts to provide clues to whether, to what degree misophonia might be influenced by cultural factors as opposed to being hardwired. And if there are things that are not culture, not culture specific, just learning more about what might give rise to misophonia. So one of the questions you asked and Chris spoke about was the association between misophonia and other mental health challenges. Is that similar around the world? We really don't know. What about the emotions that people have in response to trigger sounds? Are they the same around the world? We really don't know. And so it's possible that some of what we think about misophonia might be misleading because it's mostly based on Western data and Western reports, and there may be, for all we know, very different. So we're studying this in this new project in the United States, in Brazil, and in South Korea to start to address these issues.
Yeah. As I was reading about your study, I remember reading or hearing once that in I think it's in Japan, it's considered complimentary to slurp noodles, right? Mm-hmm. As a show of that you're enjoying the food. So,
yes.
Do we know is there misophonia in Japan, or is there like a cultural valence to it?
Yeah, that's some of the questions we are trying to ask because there's such few studies. There has been a study in China of college students, and they found similar prevalence rates as what we did. So we have that one N of one, right? I know there are other projects which are beginning to gather data, but they tend to be focused in Europe or so Western, more Western civilizations and our approaches to sounds and around eating and so on. And so this project will allow us to delve a little deeper and see what is it which is invariant perhaps across misophonia as a condition and which part is more a matter of the culture, the surrounding culture.
So we know that misophonia does exist around the world. We know it exists in South Korea because our collaborators in South Korea talk about it. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting experiences I had, we have a consultant in South Korea who's a doctor of traditional medicine who has his own website devoted to this. And I can't read Korean, but there are some images. And when I saw the images, I thought, oh, that's misophonia.
So you could tell from the images. Okay, so what sort of people are you looking for to participate in this study?
We're looking for adults 18 and over who have misophonia. We're recruiting from within about a 3-hour driving radius of Champaign-Urbana. And we want people with a wide range of ages, symptom presentations. So we're hoping to recruit 100 people. And we want a wide variety of adults who have misophonia so we can learn more about it.
Yeah, okay. And I'll say, well, if people are interested, they can email misophonia@illinois.edu. And if you are like me and you have to look up how to spell that every time you write it, we'll have a link to the study on our website, which is 21stshow.org. And you can look for how to sign up there. Chris, I want to come back to you. And I want to talk about some of the consequences of misophonia that people experience. Or has it caused trouble with relationships, be it family or coworkers, friends, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. It's something that's difficult to bring up because people aren't going to understand it, and you often get judged or blamed for having this thing. But yeah, it's affected everything. I did finally get married in my 40s, and I know that my wife has to be very cognizant of the struggles that I have. For example, we don't eat dinner together, which people think is weird. It's fine for us. We're used to it because we talk about our days at other times, but just things like that has definitely had an effect. I've quit jobs over misophonia if a particular situation was too triggering and I knew that I wasn't going to get relief. So the concept of the open office that was big 20 years ago was just a nightmare for people like me. And yeah, it can affect everything.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones at 800-222-9455. Scott is calling from Urbana on line four. Scott, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I experience what is almost, well, not almost, feels like a physical erratic movement of my eardrum at particular frequencies, not loudnesses, but for the example, the barking of a cardinal, that kind of chirping, really acoustic sounding kind of voice, just, I mean, I've learned to manage it with things like earplugs, but your conversation is making me wonder how much we know about inner ear function and some of these sounds, be they light, loudness, or frequency derived, and how that might be impacting people who have misophonia. I've been assessed as having hyperacousticity, and there was some training regimes offered, et cetera, but never really helped at all. So I'll listen off the air.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your work.
All right. Thanks for the call, Scott. Professor Hussein, do you want to take that?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Scott, for calling in, and I'm sorry about it. So it does sound more like hyperacusis to me. I have to step back and say we're still learning. So as much as I know, this sounds like you're sensitive to certain frequencies of sounds, but regardless of the source, perhaps, and the loudness of it is the key factor here. Yes, what you're doing seems appropriate, taking protection as needed, sound protection, and filtering out certain frequencies that are the most bothersome. Is helpful, but again, touch base with an audiologist would be to have a workup done.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Chris, you hinted at this near the beginning of our conversation, but what sort of coping strategies do you use? You mentioned eating dinner separately. That I'm sure that, as you acknowledge, will strike some people as a fairly significant step. I don't want to say extreme, but what are and maybe you can talk about the spectrum of coping strategies that other people you've worked with or talked to use as well.
Absolutely. I think we end up for lack. First of all, we haven't mentioned this. There is no proven treatment or medication yet for misophonia that's in the works. So in the meantime, we have coping. And for me, it's earplugs, headphones, straight up leaving. I also try to use communication and education if I can to instruct other peoples on the existence of this thing. But in general, I think we end up leading fairly isolated lives, unfortunately, until we have better treatments for it. I work from home for a reason. That's by design. And it can be isolating, hopefully not too isolating, because that can get depressing. But it's a real challenge for sure.
And I know you've written about, it's one thing if this is your life partner, somebody who's kind of for better and worse, as they say, mm-hmm. in the vows. But how do people react when you try to talk to people that you don't know as well about this? And you've written about some strategies that people might use.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you have to pick your battles, I guess. I try not to go up to strangers in the grocery store and say, hey, would you mind not popping your gum? Because that's not going to turn out well, even though I would like to do that. Yeah. If I bring it up sometimes, I'm also in the recovery community and I lead 12-step meetings. And if somebody comes in and they're chewing their gum or smacking their gum, I sometimes just say, hey, I have this really weird sensory sensitivity. Would you mind not doing that during the meeting? It's going to be distracting. And a lot of times people are like, oh, yeah, sure. And if they want more info, I can. We have free cards. They're just business cards that explain what misophonia is that we give out. We've sent them worldwide, thousands of them. Because we get so worked up emotionally, it's hard to talk about when we're triggered. So the card can kind of do the talking about misophonia for us, and I can hand those out.
Yeah.
But it's always an awkward conversation. Most people haven't heard of it, although thank goodness more people are. And it's not unusual for me to bring up the word misophonia and somebody say, oh, I've heard of that, or my aunt has that. And what a relief.
Yeah. Let's we only have a few minutes left in the show, but we have another caller on the line. Steve is calling from Rock Island on line two. Steve, thank you for calling in.
Thank you for having me.
So I understand you believe you experienced misophonia. What has that led to? What has that been like for you?
I have probably the worst case of it you've ever heard of. At least I hope there's not anybody out there worse than me. I have taken people's food and put it on the floor in restaurants that they've sounded like a pig. All I have to do is hear one lip smack, one gum pop, and I instantly see red.
Wow.
I hate to say it, but I could hurt the person that does it, but I don't. I've had this since I was a little kid. In fact, my father, who was probably the most loving, caring man you'd ever meet, he was terrible, a terrible manners, and it would be a battle every night.
Wow.
And it ended up, I would not sit at the table with him to eat.
When did you first learn that there is this concept called misophonia, that there was a name for what you felt?
Just within the last couple of years, because I always, all my friends know I'm like that. And, they all thought, something's wrong with this guy. He's wired wrong. But, when I found out that I'm not the only one like this, it was kind of a relief. But I've gone to shrinks. I've gone to psychologists and my own doctors. But they say there's, nothing more that they can do. That it's a mental condition.
Yeah. Well, Steve, thank you so much. I'm sorry you've experienced that, and I appreciate you calling in. Chris, any final words of advice to people like Steve? I know you said we don't have a treatment yet. Working on coping. Go ahead.
Steve, from one person in the misophonia, from the misosphere to another, I feel for you. I can relate completely. Reach out to us. We have the world's only peer support program for people with misophonia, where you can at least talk to other people like us and see how we cope, if it helps and get some validity. But I feel for you, man. It is very hard, and my heart breaks for that guy.
Yeah. Chris Edwards is the founder and president of SoQuiet.org, a misophonia advocacy and support nonprofit. We've also been speaking with Professors Fatima Hussein and Howard Barenbaum, respectively of the Department of Speech and Hearing Science and the Department of Psychology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. If you are interested in getting involved with their study, you can email misophonia@illinois.edu. We'll also have a link to their study and how to get involved on our website, 21stshow.org. Chris and Professor Barenbaum, Professor Hussein, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you
pleasure.
So much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that is all the time for our program today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be talking politics and policy with a leader from the Illinois General Assembly's Latino Caucus. Plus, a retired nutritionist from Dunlap, Illinois, just got back from a grueling endurance race through the Patagonia region of South America on horseback. We'll talk with her about her experience. That's tomorrow on The 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Damian Contreras. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. Visit 21stshow.org, find links to our podcast there, or just look us up on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Talk to you tomorrow.